we Americans have thought of people of color as being heterosexual and gay people as being white. You know, there's a lot of overlap. There are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people who are of color. That's a relatively advanced understanding and perception at this point in America.
Jonathan is in love with Bobby, who's in love with Claire, who's in love with both Jonathan and Bobby.
The character Bobby, I mean, obviously it was such an extreme from anything I'd played before, which was the usual butch swagger, brooding, you know, it was so different. I just wanted to challenge myself.
In case anybody doesn't know, God calls it an abomination.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Nova Scotia jumps on the Canadian marriage bandwagon. Newsweek chief Marcus Mabry talks race, sex, and the press. And a Tony winner and an Irish hunk make a home at the end of the world. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 25th, 2004. The Canadian province of Nova Scotia issued its first marriage license to a gay male couple this week. A lawsuit filed in August by three same-gender couples was not opposed by either the provincial or federal governments. Nova Scotia Supreme Court Justice Heather Robertson declared the province's one-man, one-woman definition of marriage unconstitutional and changed it to read two persons. She added that marriages of gay and lesbian couples performed outside of Nova Scotia would also be recognized in the province, including the Ontario marriage of lesbian plaintiffs Kim Vance and Samantha Meehan. Plaintiffs Brian and Ron Garnett Doucette, a couple of 20 years standing, went directly from the courtroom to an office in Halifax to apply for their marriage license. They're still planning their wedding, but had confidently bought their wedding rings the day before the court ruling. The third plaintiff couple was Brian Mombourquette and Ross Boutillier, who had a wedding ceremony in 1994. For that occasion, Boutillier was denied marriage leave by his employer, the federal government agency Natural Resources Canada, and he's fought that decision in courts and human rights tribunals ever since. Courts in Ontario, British Columbia, Manitoba, Quebec, and the Yukon Territory have all created marriage equality since mid-2003. The long-awaited hearing in the Supreme Court of Canada on the constitutional questions the federal government posed in drafting legislation for marriage equality is scheduled for October 4.
The U.S. movement to prohibit marriage to same-gender couples took a nasty turn this month, a week before Louisiana voters gave 4-1 approval to amending the state constitution to deny all forms of marriage-like recognition to those couples. TV preacher Jimmy Swaggart used his broadcast pulpit to forward that campaign. Baton Rouge-based Swaggart continues to draw a significant audience despite having been caught with female sex workers in 1988 and 1991 after extensively criticizing some of his colleagues for extramarital affairs. On September 12th, he denounced
politicians dancing around this utter, absolute, asinine, idiotic stupidity. Of men marrying men. I've never seen a man in my life I wanted to marry.
Then he added his most offensive remark.
And I'm going to be blunt and plain. If one ever looks at me like that, I'm going to kill him and tell God he died. In case anybody doesn't know, God calls it an abomination. It's an abomination. It's an abomination!
He continued to denounce district attorneys, judges, and state legislatures for not sharing that view, saying
they ought to have to marry a pig and live with them forever. And I thank God that President Bush has stated we need a constitutional amendment that states that marriage is between a man and a woman.
A Toronto TV station's broadcast of the message led to a complaint to the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council.
U.S. gays and lesbians primarily learned of it on the internet until reports this week that Swaggart had apologized. He said he's often used the kill him and tell God he's dead phrase in many contexts and that it's a humorous statement that doesn't mean anything, but that he won't use it again. He declared that he's totally opposed to any type of violence against anyone. He said that homosexuals should be treated like everyone else, but that he's opposed to homosexuality and that he'll continue to preach against homosexuality, but do it the right way. None of that was good enough for Human Rights Campaign President Cheryl Jakes, who declared he should use his position in the pulpit to speak up for equal treatment for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. His initial comments encourage an environment where hate crimes occur. We appreciate his apology, but it's imperative that he do more. Swaggart was further criticized by religious leaders in resolutions from both the Greater Baton Rouge Federation of Churches and Synagogues and the National Conference for Community and Justice, formerly known as the National Conference of Christians and Jews.
Parental rights of partnered gays and lesbians were the subject of an Idaho State Supreme Court decision this week, a decision that was viewed as a victory for those parents, although a defeat for the gay father in the case. When Theron McGriff's wife divorced him, they maintained joint custody of their two daughters for 3 years. But when she learned he was involved with a man, she sought sole custody entirely on that basis. The trial judge awarded her sole custody, despite the court's own therapist's recommendation for continued joint custody. He even ordered that McGriff could not have visitation with his daughters if he were living with his male partner, although the mother has allowed some visitation since. Sadly for McGriff, the Supreme Court let the trial judge's decision stand, agreeing the mother is best suited for sole custody of the children. However, the 5 Supreme Court justices agreed on the more general point that sexual orientation in and of itself cannot be the basis for awarding or removing custody. Only one of them felt that the lower court should not have considered McGriff's orientation at all. The 4-1 majority stated that only when the parent's sexual orientation is shown to cause harm to the child, such that the child's best interests are not served, should sexual orientation be a factor in determining custody. These more general declarations are a landmark first for Idaho, as well as the first state Supreme Court ruling on gay and lesbian custody since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down criminal laws against homosexual acts last year.
A French court ruling made public this week is the first in that nation to legally recognize a lesbian family, declaring a legal link between each of the parents as well as joint exercise of parental authority. The French government is actively opposing marriage for same-gender couples, and adoptions even by single gays and lesbians are legal only in the Paris and Hérault regions. The longtime couple are known only by their first names, Carla and Marie-Laura. Marie-Laura bore their 3 daughters by artificial insemination, which is legally denied to lesbians in France. The couple went to Belgium for the procedure. Given all the legal barriers, the couple's route to joint parental status was anything but straightforward. In 2001, biological mother Marie-Laura gave up all her legal parental standing so that Carla could adopt all 3 girls. Only last year did a change in French law make it possible for Marie-Laura to apply to resume her parental status, with Carla retaining her own standing. Although the government sought dismissal of her case, charging the women had deliberately sought to circumvent legislators' wishes, a family court judge of the Tribunal de Grande Instance in Paris in July found it in the best interest of the children to recognize both women as mothers and as linked themselves. When state prosecutors did not appeal the decision, it took effect in mid-August. French Justice Minister Dominique Perbend insists this does not set a firm precedent, but some legal experts believe otherwise.
The General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in New Zealand this week gave 63% approval to deny leadership positions to anyone involved in a sexual relationship outside of a faithful marriage between a man and a woman. This is intended to apply to heterosexual as well as gay and lesbian relationships, although same-gender couples do not have the option of marriage in New Zealand. A separate vote established that the rule will be enforced immediately, even though the proposal will spend about 2 years more under consideration by individual congregations and will face another General Assembly vote next year. It will not be enforced retroactively on those currently in leadership positions or training. Roughly 1 in 10 New Zealanders identify as affiliated with the Presbyterian Church, which has been wrestling with this issue ever since declaring in 1985 that homosexual orientation per se is not sinful.
Thousands of South African gays and lesbians of every race marched this week in Johannesburg's Pride Parade, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the 1994 National Constitution that was the first in the world to explicitly protect them from discrimination. It was the 15th Pride March for the city, and it's still the biggest on the continent. And despite last week's hoopla as police threatened to use a 1993 anti-terrorism law to arrest anyone whose mask or face makeup interfered with identification, there were drag queens galore and no detentions. However, police did closely monitor and videotape the event.
And finally, Angels in America, openly gay playwright Tony Kushner's gay and AIDS-themed masterpiece, dominated this week's Primetime Emmy Awards as its HBO production won a record 11 trophies. The six-hour special had 10 other nominations. As Kushner accepted his statuette for the script, he thanked his partner, saying, "Someday soon we can have a legal marriage license and you can make an honest homosexual out of me." Other Angels winners called for action against AIDS in Africa. The final season of HBO's comedy series Sex and the City brought acting honors to its lead, Sarah Jessica Parker, and supporting player Cynthia Nixon. Nixon, who played redheaded attorney Miranda, was revealed later in the week by the New York Daily News to have been dating a woman since January, having split with her longtime male partner more than a year ago. Confronted by the news about her relationship, she said, "My private life is private, but at the same time I have nothing to hide. So what I will say is that I'm very happy." The outstanding reality show winner was Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, Bravo Cable's male makeover series that became an international phenomenon. At the Creative Arts Emmy Gathering, held the day before the big televised gala, the show's Fab Five openly gay stars accepted the statuette, with Carson Kressley saying, "None of us have ever been so happy to take home a lady."
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 25th, 2004. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
In a fascinating new film, a pair of boyhood pals grows up to be an unconventional trio. Our Steve Pry does the math later in the program.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Extra.
It's no secret that the press has historically had a hard time negotiating the intersection of race, sexual orientation, and gender. This Way Out's John Beaupre asks award-winning Newsweek Chief of Correspondents Marcus Mabry, who's been the magazine's Paris correspondent, Johannesburg bureau chief, and a senior editor for Newsweek International, if there's been any progress along that road.
Generally, I think the media in this country is doing a lousy job of covering the intersection of those two areas, race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation and issues. I think the reason that is because traditionally in America, looking back historically, we were talking about a very, very small amount of time, a generation really, in which the visibility of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Americans has been something that's known in the general population. A generation is not long. We're only talking about a little more than a generation since civil rights existed for African Americans and other minorities in this country in a really important, visible, and significant way. Therefore, for that generation, we Americans have thought of people of color as being heterosexual and gay people as being white. That has been what has evolved as the perception of those different groups of communities has come to the American mind. We have a long way to go before we realize that, you know, there's a lot of overlap. There are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people who are of color. That's a relatively advanced understanding and perception at this point in America. I think it's going to change. I think if we look at the history, for instance, of the high visibility and the transformation of acceptance with regards to gay men and lesbians in this country, it was inextricably linked, in my eye, to a crisis, and that crisis being the HIV/AIDS crisis starting in the early 80s. That changed everything. The fact that younger Americans today come out in their teens and often, the fact that young people today in large majorities support marriage between same-sex couples as between all other Americans, these are things that are, the result of the AIDS crisis, which said to all of us, you know what, it kills you to stay in the closet, and it kills us to not be visible in this society. For people of color who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, sadly, I think that kind of crisis is at our doorstep right now in certainly the gay black community, we are facing a similar crisis of incredibly significant proportions with relation to HIV and AIDS. And the only silver lining I could hope for from what's happening, from the catastrophe affecting our community, is that it will mean to say it will be an edifying experience for us, whereby we say no more. We can't live in the closet, our lies, or unproud of ourselves anymore. We have to come out to save ourselves. So I think it's going to change. I think finally we're seeing differences. We're seeing more examples of people of color who are gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgendered in the media, even in advertising, where it's, you know, not directed to a market segment even. You know, we're seeing them in stories. In the New York Times, you'll see a story about taxes and family life, and the couple will be an interracial couple, and well, it will be gay. So we're seeing progress slowly. It always happens this way, but what we still have not yet seen is that kind of demand from our community as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender communities of color, that we exist, we're here, we're queer. And that hasn't happened yet, and I hope it will.
I'm going to ask a personal question, which I've always wanted to ask you. It seems to me that an awful lot of lesbian gay journalists have a fierce pride and a kind of an overbearing militance and a kind of a power, and God bless them. I mean, they've made a huge change in the world we live in. You have always come off as an extremely joyful, effulgent, if I can use that adjective. I don't know anyone else has ever used that adjective in the last 20 years. You come up with a lot of joy with what you do and the pleasure of what you do. Where do you suppose that comes from?
I have no idea. Good therapy? I think my partner may say, well, no, you know, he's a Gemini, so it's up and down like a roller coaster. I guess where it comes from in my public persona is the fact that I don't see a choice. One could sit around and gripe or be, you know, militant, and that's fine. It's important that we as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people be all over the political spectrum, although there are not many of us who are in certain camps. At the same time, I think it's really important that we take all the avenues. I think it's important that we be the ebullient and joyful person and the person working from the inside, climbing the corporate ladder. I don't think that's a sellout. I think it's important to be there, because if you're not there, you can't affect change either. We have to be there, and we have to be outside, raising hell and raising our fists and raising our voices and demanding change now, not evolution or reform, but revolution now. We have to be both places, because you know what? If you're in one place and not the other, you're not going to be as successful. It's a lot more fun for me, personally, to be this way. Some folks, like Larry Kramer, who I respect greatly and who I've talked to and who's even been at Newsweek on panels after the 20th anniversary of AIDS issue that we did at the magazine, Larry only has one speed. And I love that. And I think it's amazing. And he gave this incredibly depressing and just devastating commentary about, you know, how, you know, it's too late, we're all going to die, and it's, you know, over, and we all have fallen down, you know, on our duties, and none of us give a shit, none of us do enough. And afterwards, I said, you know how that made me sound like a young gay man? That really was devastating to me, because that meant you're telling me to give up now. And he said, you know what? And he said, you know, look, honey, that's what I have to say publicly, because, you know, because you got to take people off to make them act. But he said, you know, privately, no, I haven't given up hope. No, not at all. And you keep doing what you're doing, and I'm happy you're there. And there is hope. And my mom and my grandmom, who raised me, this is who they made me. And I think my grandmother had this real dire kind of fourth grade education, black woman from southern rural Georgia, which is really as deep south as you can get. And all she believed that life would give you is hard work, and you'd have your reward in the hereafter, but she's expecting nothing from the world. My mom was the opposite, and she was a total dreamer, never implemented a plan in her life. You know, she always had great dreams, but never followed through. Those two people together, my mother, who always had, you know, her hands stretched out for the sky, and my grandmom, who had her feet so firmly planted in the ground that it was, I think, a depressing life for her. Those two qualities, I think, really made me the man I am today. And that's, to work your butt off and expect nothing in the return from the world is an amazing, blessed place to be in some ways. Because you know that work is what there is. That's what life gives you. That's what my grandmom taught me. At the same time, you know that you should never stop dreaming. That's what my mom taught me. And those two things together, I feel incredibly lucky that those were the two people who had the greatest influence on my life. And it affects my life every day.
That was Newsweek Chief of Correspondents Marcus Mabry in conversation with This Way Out's John Beaupre.
Hi, I'm B.D. Wong. I'm the actor from Law & Order Special Victims Unit and Oz, and the author of Following Foo, the Electronic Adventures of the Chestnut Man, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. Oh yeah, I'm a gay guy.
What's the sum of a Pulitzer Prize-winning gay novelist known for Melancholy Fair, a Tony-winning gay director known for musical comedy, and a straight Irish heartthrob? This Way Out's Steve Pride has the answer to that question.
Based on the book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Cunningham, A Home at the End of the World chronicles the lives of Bobby and Jonathan, inseparable childhood friends. When Bobby comes to live with Jonathan's family, the sexual curiosity of adolescence bonds them forever. Years later, when they reunite in New York, combined with Jonathan's free-spirited roommate Claire, they invent a new kind of family. Jonathan is in love with Bobby, who's in love with Claire, who's in love with both Jonathan and Bobby. The trio moves to Woodstock, New York, where Claire has a baby, Jonathan and Bobby open a business, and everyone works to ensure three's company and not a crowd.
This town's crying out for a cool little cafe.
This town's crying out for an outlet mall.
What? It has possibilities.
Where? Point out a possibility.
Kitchen's basically okay. Just needs a good cleaning.
Look, wood floors.
Is that a termite?
No. Oh, yeah, maybe.
I think I got a name. The Home Cafe. What do you think?
Well, be better for business than the Squalor and Desperation Cafe, I suppose.
The film features Robin Wright Penn as Claire, Dallas Roberts as Jonathan, and Colin Farrell as Bobby. Farrell says he was immediately drawn to the project.
The writing was so beautiful, man. I mean, from the novel to the script, or as I read it from the script to the novel, it was just, it was about so many beautiful things. It was about love, it was about hope, it was about togetherness, finding your companion, finding a place in the world, finding a way of existing or coexisting that soothes your soul. But and being about all those things, it sounds like it could be twee, it could be corny, and it was just done with such a delicate brush. It was written with such a delicate brush, as Michael Cunningham is such a beautiful writer, and I'd never read characters like them, because they're all quite different. I mean, Jonathan, Claire, and Bobby are all quite different characters, and yet Bobby and Jonathan have this innate understanding of each other. And Claire comes into the fold, or Bobby comes into Jonathan and Claire's fold. But the writing was so beautifully written. I just loved it. And the character Bobby, I mean, obviously it was such an extreme from anything I'd played before, which was the usual butch swagger, brooding, you know, it was so different. I just wanted to challenge myself.
Claire loves you. I love Claire. Doesn't this all seem sort of strange?
No, man. It's perfect. Just like this.
Bobby, I'm starting to feel a little extra.
You're essential, man. Mm-mm. Hey, let's dance.
You can't dance to opera.
You can dance to anything. Dallas's character, Jonathan, is quite an intellectual, cerebral character. You know, he's very quick-witted, and his tongue can match his wit and keep up with it. Claire, the same. And Bobby, he just enjoys other people's love and other people's happiness, and he finds his own in that. So in respect to that, he wasn't the most verbal of characters. Plus, he doesn't judge, he doesn't... he never... breaks down a situation. He never thinks of cause and effect. He just is so in the moment that by the time he has something to say, the moment's gone. Do you know the way? So he kind of, you know, yow is about the extent of his articulacy. But a lot of it is, again, about the physical space, which is why Michael Mayer was so good, because coming from theatre, he had a great understanding of blocking. We rehearsed quite a bit, and then we got on the different sets. He was very quick with, he kind of knew... which could get a bit grating, because you got to find him, you know. But he kind of had a great idea of where people should be and what the space should be.
Out director Michael Mayer is best known for his Tony-nominated stage adaptation of Thoroughly Modern Millie, and this was his first film.
What I didn't know was how much fun I would have. doing it. And I didn't know that temperamentally I was as well suited to the endeavor as I was. The control freak in me sort of really blossomed. It was great because I had, I could, micromanage everything. I didn't, and in the moment too, which is incredibly fun for me.
Early on, the media focused on what wasn't in the final film. As originally shot, Colin Farrell has an extended full frontal nude scene.
I wouldn't have shot it if I had a problem with it ever being in. I mean, you don't give people who make films the option. Purely, it seemed to detract from the beauty of the image of Bobby and Jonathan together with the camera looking over the bed and Bobby curled up in a fetal position, like a child asking Jonathan what's wrong with him, when what's obviously wrong with Jonathan is that Bobby's completely naked and he was just naked in bed with Claire. But to see me standing in a doorframe walking in, it just detracted from it. It just made it not as powerful, not as beautiful, honestly. I mean, it didn't come from any puritanical place, obviously, and it doesn't sell the film short at all.
Michael Cunningham is not known for uplifting stories, and A Home at the End of the World is no exception. Jonathan develops AIDS. But even so, Colin Farrell doesn't see this film as a tragedy.
At the end of the day, he loves Jonathan. He loves Jonathan so much. So there is kind of warped optimism within all this pain and all this tragedy and all this, loss. There is a warped sense of optimism. And there are sad times ahead for Bobby. And Bobby's going to lead Jonathan to his death. That's what's going to happen at the end of the film. Bobby's going to nurse Jonathan until he dies, which is probably within the year. Medicine wasn't as effective there, so I'm guessing within the year or two. That's pretty sad. But I think for the first time ever, Bobby will be okay on his own, is the thing. That's the huge change for Bobby. Probably doesn't come across, but for the first time ever, he'll be okay on his own.
Director Michael Mayer.
Basically, it's a search for home. It's a search for family. It's a kind of saga or epic, for each of the characters to stake out their own identity and to create a life for themselves. Everyone can relate to that. It's that coming of age story in a sense.
Hey. You wanna dance?
What?
Come on.
This has been a conversation with Michael Mayer and Colin Farrell. For more information on this film, visit their website at ahomeattheendoftheworld.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, John Beaupre, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to Rita Gonzalez and Kathy Sanchez. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Only you can keep this program on the air and get some queer history, music, and culture on specially produced CDs in the bargain, too. For all the details, please do log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WLUW Chicago, Illinois, to UUU Nowra, New South Wales, KRFC Fort Collins, Colorado, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we know you'll stay tuned.